Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind. Graphic Audio presents Simon R. Green's Deathstalker Legacy. Narrated by Richard Rowan, with performances by Michael Glenn, David Coyne, Vanessa Benjamin, Sonny Lasky, Corey James, Bruce Rauscher, Nanette Savard, Jeff Baker, Ken Jackson, Kate Torrey, Christopher Graybill, Terrence Aselford, Tim Carlin, Chris Rowan, Nathaniel Perry, and Mort Shelby. Graphic audio sound design by Chris Rowan. Adapted for graphic audio and directed by Richard Rowan. Episode 2, Winning Friends and Influencing People. Parliament was the bedrock of human politics, the solid center of law and justice around which the great wheel of empire turned. All important decisions flowed from the great debates on the floor of Parliament, establishing a legal and moral framework for all humankind to live by, no matter how scattered they might be across the wide breadth of the modern empire. The people knew this to be true because Parliament told them it was so. In fact, there was an entire department with a very large budget funded entirely by Parliament, whose job it was to tell the people of the empire what a great job their members were doing for them. After all, how would the people know they were living in a golden age if the media didn't keep reminding them? Nothing was actually hidden from the people. The facts were all there, good and bad, in open record. But unless you knew where to look, and the right questions to ask, and the right people to ask, and the context to put their answers in, the information you got wouldn't actually mean much to you. So, most people didn't bother. The professionals in Parliament knew what they were doing. They must. It was a golden age, wasn't it? The members of Parliament met in a single great house, a familiar and much beloved sight in the Parade of the Endless. Designed 2 centuries ago by the most prominent and respected designer of King Robert's time, the house was an immense, gleaming edifice of steel and glass, its long, cool, organic curves rising and falling in gentle waves that were striking, but still restful to the eye. It won every design award of its day, including a few they made up especially for it. Only the truly ungrateful pointed out that if you let your eyes wander over the rising and falling curves long enough, you could get seriously seasick. And everyone in the empire with a view screen was familiar with the grand open floor of Parliament, where all important business was discussed. The great semicircle of seats faced the single golden throne of the king as speaker, each seat representing a world in the empire. At present, 750 planets had their own seat in Parliament, with another 500 or so of the more recently colonized worlds waiting impatiently for their population to rise to the point where they would be entitled to a seat and a vote in Parliament. Not everyone got to speak all the time, of course. There were strict rules of order and precedence, and all questions had to be submitted well in advance. And only the truly cynical would point out how easy it would be for certain vested interests to decide who got to be heard and who wouldn't. To the left and right of the seats were the open areas for the lesser seats, though of course no one ever called them that in public. To the left, the clone and Esper representatives. To the right, the AIs and the aliens, who got to have their say on a regular basis, just not very often. Pressure of business, you see. The only time everyone got a theoretically equal chance to speak was during the great debates on matters of general policy. And it just so happened that King Douglas's first day as speaker coincided with the first such debate in months on the particularly thorny issue of aliens' rights and representation in the House and in the Empire. Except, of course, it wasn't a coincidence. Parliament was throwing Douglas in the deep end to see what he was made of. All the media would be there, Not just the 24-hour news channel, so beloved of news and politics junkies, but the gossip and celebrity shows as well. If the new king was going to put his mark on the political process, or fall flat on his face and make a complete prat of himself, everyone wanted to see it. Live. It would be the biggest audience the House had had for months. The honorable members were spending even more time in makeup than usual, to be sure they looked their best for their supporters back home. This was the public face of modern politics, and most people were content with that. They never got to see the warren of small rooms and narrow corridors that made up the majority of the House, where all the people who did the real work of governing the empire got together in small groups to wave papers at each other, argue furiously, drink lots and lots of bad coffee, and wheel and deal over the real decisions of everyday politics. Members might decide overall policy, but it was the small army of career civil servants who decided what got done and when, and heaven protect any member fool enough to forget that. Real power is never where you think it is, and just as in show business, what goes on behind the scenes is just as important as what the audience sees out front. In one of these small back rooms, tucked well away from the main ebb and flow, the new king and his people were busily preparing for his first day as speaker. To be exact, Douglas Campbell was sitting slumped in a chair in the corner, while everyone else bustled around preparing themselves for the day's session. Douglas was wearing his kingly robes, but already they looked rumpled and untidy, as though he'd slept in them. The crown was set to one side on top of a filing cabinet, because the weight of it gave Douglas a headache and rubbed a raw spot on his forehead. His scowl slowly deepened as he worked his way doggedly through the thick sheaf of papers Ann Barkley had stuffed into his hand the moment he walked in. This was on top of all the paperwork she'd insisted he study the night before. Information was ammunition, and he couldn't afford to be caught out if an MP asked him a pointed question on the floor of the House. Members could specialize, but the king had to know everything, or at least be able to fake it convincingly. Louis Deathstalker, the new champion, looked over the security systems one last time and moved over to stand uncomfortably at Douglas's side. Uncomfortable mostly because of the new champion's outfit that Anne had insisted he wear. She'd had it designed especially for him, and Louis really wished she hadn't. Black leather armor, very form-fitting, with a stylized gold crown in bas-relief on his chest, right over his heart. Louis thought it made a great target to aim at. The leather also pinched in all the wrong places. At least he still had his own familiar sword and gun, comforting weights on his hips, ready to hand. Anne had tried to make him wear some flashy ceremonial sword, but there were limits. Jewel-encrusted hilts did not make for a good grip.
Darling! Oh my, this looks fascinating!
Jessamine Flowers, the queen-to-be, fluttered around the cramped little room like a gorgeous butterfly. Resplendent in flowing pastels and jangling jewelry, alighting here and there, wherever something caught her interest.
What do we have here?
Her hair had been pulled back in a formal bun, and her makeup was relatively understated, but she was still a bright and glamorous figure. Anne had gone to great pains to tactfully explain to Jessamine that she mustn't overshadow the king on his first public appearance in the House, but short of putting a bag over her head, there wasn't much Jessamine could do. She dazzled. It was what she did. It didn't help that there wasn't really anything for her to do, so she kept herself busy, taking an interest in everything and getting in everyone's way. The room was packed with state-of-the-art computers, security and surveillance tech, some of it so newly installed the boxes it came in were still piled up in the corners. Instruction manuals were scattered all over, already heavily bookmarked and dog-eared. All kinds of equipment had been piled haphazardly on top of each other, often disturbingly precariously, and one entire wall of the room had disappeared behind banks of monitor screens showing ever-changing images of the rest of the House. There was also a top-of-the-line food processor and an arcane piece of equipment that promised to make first-class coffee, if they could ever figure out how to make it do what it was supposed to do. Anne Barkley, in another of her smart gray suits, moved quickly from computer terminal to monitor screen and back again, her eyes darting furiously over the incoming information. And jotting down notes to herself on her personal planner as she went.
We'll have to do something about that.
She was in her element, and loving every minute of it. She'd been up most of the night and all of that morning preparing the way for Douglas's big day, and if it wasn't a great success, by God, someone was going to pay for it, and it sure as hell wasn't going to be her. She'd pulled every string, called in every favor she was owed, bullied and cajoled all the right people, and covered every eventuality she could think of. But it was the nature of politics that it could always surprise you, and rarely pleasantly. Jessamine finally ran out of things to distract her, scooped some empty boxes out of a chair, and dropped into it, crossing her long legs with elegant flair.
I just love what you've done with this place, Anne, darling. It's so you.
Anne deliberately refused to look away from what she was doing.
Originally, Robert and Constance had this room set aside just for them, so they'd have somewhere private they could sit and talk and do a little secret plotting and planning without being interrupted all the time. It later evolved into an information gathering and sorting station so they could stay on top of things. All the best equipment, and apparently they ran it themselves so they wouldn't have to worry about who they could and couldn't trust. King and Parliament were still working out the order of things in those days, and in the ever-changing political situation, Robert and Constance were determined to keep on top of things. William and Niamh, on the other hand, inherited a much more stable operation, and were apparently content to let it pretty much run itself. As far as I can tell, neither of them used this room much, if at all. William just turned up at the house when required, nodded in the right places when he thought anyone was looking at him, and saved his energies for state occasions and public appearances. At which, it must be said that he and Niamh were very good. No one could smile and wave like they could. I only knew this place existed because it was mentioned in Robert's private notes, which I inherited when I became head of protocol. I had to access the house's original blueprints to track it down. When I finally opened the place up, it was inches deep in dust, and what tech there was so hopelessly outdated, I wouldn't have been surprised to find it ran on steam. I've had to build this operation up from scratch.
Douglas looked up from his papers for the first time.
Hold everything. Who's footing the bill for all this new equipment?
Not you. As head of protocol, I have a more than generous budget. And a perfect willingness to cook the books should it prove necessary. You get back to your homework.
Jessamine looked over at Douglas.
How is your father, dear? How's he adjusting to retirement?
Like a duck to water.
Douglas dropped the last of the papers into his lap, glad of an excuse for a break.
He's retired to his country estate, pulled up the drawbridge, and is happily puttering around with his computers, playing at being the historian he always wanted to be.
I'll lay good money he hasn't got anything to match the state-of-the-art tech I scared up for you.
Anne was finally standing still, and she looked around the room triumphantly.
Some of this stuff is so new, it came here straight from the development labs. If these computers were any smarter, they'd apply to join the AIs on Shub. We can predict trends, extrapolate from late-breaking news, and outguess any political pundits in the media. I've got information coming into this room non-stop from every civilized world in the Empire, from all the gossip and news channels, all of it flagged and bookmarked to sort out what we need to know from what we don't. And let us not forget the private and very juicy stuff trickling in from my own intelligence people. Douglas, you are going to be the wisest, sharpest, and best-prepared speaker this house has ever seen. Those poor bastards on the floor won't know what's hit them, especially since I am currently hacked into the house's own internal security and surveillance systems. From here, we can see everything that happens in the house as it happens.
Everything?
Lewis raised an eyebrow.
Well, all right, maybe not everything. There are still a few places I can't access, private bolt holes like this one that aren't on the official lists, but we've got a much better overview than anyone else, and no one knows it but us. No one's going to be sneaking up on us.
Excuse me?
Jessamine held up her hand, as though she were in class.
Are you saying we're using Parliament's own security systems to spy on the MPs and their people? I mean, is that legal?
We work for the King. If he says it's legal, it's legal.
It's legal.
Oh, intrigue, secrets, voyeurism and potential blackmail. Oh, darlings, I never knew politics could be such fun.
As long as we don't get caught.
Party pooper. Don't be such a wet blanket, Lewis. We're embarking on a great adventure here. You have got to get into the swing of things.
Lewis looked at her doubtfully and tugged at his new outfit again, trying to persuade the black leather into some position where it might hang a bit more comfortably. Anne didn't even look up from what she was doing.
Leave it alone, Lewis. It's supposed to hang like that. It's part of the image. You look very sharp, very dramatic.
Look like an executioner for one of the old adventure serials. All I need is a hood and an axe, and children would run screaming for me in the streets. And it itches. Why couldn't I have stayed with my old paragon armor?
Because you're not a paragon anymore. You are the first king's champion in 200 years, and it's important you look the part.
I like it. It's very theatrical. Reminds me of one of those old S&M supervillains from the old Julian Sky shows.
You see? I'm gonna be a laughing stock. I just know it.
Be quiet, all of you. I still have a hell of a lot of this paperwork to get under my belt before I'm on.
Douglas looked down at the papers in his lap, and then looked at Anne.
Why am I wading through all this shit, Anne? Can't you just prompt me as necessary over my private comm channel?
Yes, if you don't mind appearing hesitant and unsure. And if you're willing to risk the comm channel being jammed at a particularly inopportune moment. It's what I'd do if I wanted to make you look bad. You have to be prepared for everything the honorable members and their staff can throw at you. Those last few pages you've got are particularly important. They're my very latest intelligence reports on which MPs are on our side, which aren't, who wouldn't be even if we paid them, and those who might just be swayed by a really good performance today. Parliament is all about allies and enemies and how they can switch from one to the other according to the subject you're discussing.
I thought it was supposed to be about passing laws, establishing ethical structures, and deciding questions of principles.
Douglas and Anne and Jessamine all looked at him for a moment.
Don't be silly, Lewis. Decisions are made in the House by majority vote, which means if you want to get anything done, you have to convince other people to support you. And that means making deals. I support you on this, and you support me on that. This is politics. If you want morality, go to church.
Very succinct, Jess. I'm surprised. You've been studying up on this, haven't you?
Darling, I've always believed in researching my roles thoroughly. And politics and show business are really very similar. In the end, it all comes down to egos.
You should know.
Jessamine smiled at Lewis.
I will make you suffer hideously for that, sweetie.
Hush, children, or Mama Spank. Douglas, it's vitally important you make a good impression on your first day as Speaker. You have to establish yourself as a useful presence and a strong character, but with no personal axe to grind. By the end of today, we need you to be loved, admired, respected, and even a little feared.
All on my first day? Couldn't I start with something simpler, like walking on water?
It's all down to image, presenting the right appearance. You act the part convincingly enough and everyone will believe it, even you. That's true of politics or show business.
I will not be acting. I will not lie to the House or pretend to be what I'm not. I became king to lead by example, and that's what I will do.
Oh, then you won't last long in politics. No one's asking you to lie, Douglas. Just to be careful what you say and how you say it. You can't lead by example if no one's sure exactly what example you're trying to set. What did I tell you last night? Presentation, presentation, presentation!
Douglas sank back in his chair, pouting sulkily.
Feels just like my first day at school. Don't know anything or anyone, wondering where the toilets are and if I've forgotten my lunch money. Things were so much simpler when I was just a paragon. And I feel naked without my weapons.
You can't bear arms in Parliament. No one can. It's traditional. Otherwise, you'd have duels on the floor of the House any time someone looked like they were losing an argument. Lewis only gets to wear his because as champion, he's your official bodyguard. From now on, we're your weapons. Lewis and Jess and me. You point us at your problems and we solve them for you. Don't be nervous, Douglas.
I'm not nervous. I just want to get on with it. Get a move on. All this sitting around waiting to go is driving me crazy.
Easy.
Lewis moved in closer to Douglas to be supportive.
Let the enemy do the worrying. We know all about them, and they don't know a damn thing about what we're planning. Use that.
Just play it cool. Don't let them rattle you. Some of them will undoubtedly try to throw you just to see if they can. But they only think they're testing you. In reality, we're testing them, looking for their weak spots, searching out their hidden pressure points. The only king and speaker they've known is your father. They're too used to having their own way to take you seriously. until it's too late. By the time we're finished, we'll be playing Parliament like a musical instrument, and we'll be calling the tune, because we're smarter and better prepared than they are.
No, because I am concerned with morality, not politics. Lewis was partly right. I care about doing the right thing, not what's currently expedient, which means I will never be confused or uncertain as to what my position is or whether I should compromise. I won't. Never forget that, Anne. We're not here to win, we're here to do some good.
Ooh, darling, I get goosebumps all over when you talk like that. If you're really good, I might just show you later. Oh, wait until I'm queen and sitting there beside you in state, looking down on all the poor little politicians as you make them do the right thing for once.
Jess, you don't actually get to sit in state, in the house. Not even when you're queen, it's tradition. The king has a place there as speaker, you don't.
Jessamine looked at her.
I don't get a throne in the house.
No, Jess.
Then where do I sit?
You don't. You stand on Douglas's left hand while Lewis stands on his right.
Stuff that for a game of soldiers. I do not just stand around. My days as an extra and supporting player are long past. I am a star.
Not in Parliament, you're not. You have no official position in the House. Douglas doesn't as King, only as Speaker. The Queen can't speak in the debates, and you don't get a vote. You're only allowed to be present as a courtesy. Make no mistake, Jess. Parliament is a battleground, just like the arenas. In fact, you'd probably find more mercy on the bloody sands. You make a wrong move in front of the MPs, and they will tear you apart and use you as a club to beat Douglas with. This isn't like show business, where the worst a poor performance can get you is a bad review. If they see you as a weak link they can use to undermine Douglas's position, I'll have no choice but to ban you from the house. So for now, you watch in silence, smiling graciously, and you don't interfere. There'll be plenty for you to do backstage and in public, but this is Douglas's territory, not yours. Is that clear?
Jessamine glared at Anne, and then shrugged.
Oh, bully. I'll make my mark, you wait and see. Just not in the house. So what are you going to be doing while I'm standing around like a spare bridesmaid at a wedding?
I have even less right to be in the house than you do. I'm just head of protocol, really nothing more than a glorified civil servant. I'll be right here, watching everything on the monitors. I'll still be able to talk to you through your comm implants, offering advice and late-breaking information. I've done everything I can to establish a private channel they can't access or jam, but if I do black out for a while, don't panic. I will get back to you. If you need to talk to me, sub-vocalize. I'll hear you. But keep it cryptic. Some MPs have been known to employ lip readers.
It looks like most of the honorable members are already in the house.
She rose gracefully to her feet and drifted over to study the changing images on the monitor screens.
Oh, it looks very crowded. I don't remember seeing half this many MPs in the House for ages.
Of course not.
Anne joined her at the monitors.
Even the most important debates don't attract crowds like this. Only a fraction of an MP's work gets done on the floor of the House. The real deals get sorted out behind the scenes. No, Douglas, this is all for you.
Oh, wonderful. I must remember to send them all nice little thank you notes.
Anne pointed out some of the more famous names and faces to Jessamine, who found something insulting and appalling to say about all of them. Lewis took the opportunity for a quiet word with Douglas.
Why didn't you tell me I was going to be your champion? Why spring it on me like that? I could have used some time to prepare myself.
Not a chance. I know you, Lewis. If I'd have given you any time to think about it, you'd have found some way to talk yourself out of it. You always were too damned modest, too lacking in ambition for your own good, which was one of the main reasons why I chose you. And because we'd always worked so well together as partners. I needed a champion I could rely on, someone I knew I could trust.
You couldn't trust Finn Durandal?
Hell no! Finn's always had his own agenda. He wanted to be champion for all the wrong reasons. And after what he did to the elves in the arena... He didn't execute them so justice could be served. He killed them because he took their assault in his territory as a slap in the face. He butchered them all, in cold blood, because they made him look bad.
Well, that's a bit harsh, isn't it?
Is it?
Finn's a good man at heart. A bit cold, yes. Not the easiest of people to get on with. But he really is the greatest paragon we've ever had. No one can match his record.
And none of that means anything if he did it for the wrong reasons.
Finn's a killer, Lewis. So he went where the killing was. The arenas could never satisfy someone like him, because when he kills someone in the streets, they stay dead.
That's a terrible thing to say.
Do you doubt it's true?
Lewis shook his head slowly.
So, you didn't choose me just because I'm a Deathstalker?
No. I chose you because you're Lewis. Because there's no one else I'd rather have at my side.
They smiled at each other for a long moment. Two old friends, still partners, setting out on a great new adventure. Then Douglas went back to looking through his last few papers. Lewis looked around the room and pulled irritably at his collar again.
Even so, it feels weird just standing around like this. Usually by this time of the day we'd be on our third case and already fallen behind schedule. Never thought I'd miss getting up far too early in the morning to go out on patrol. And speaking of that, there's one thing I've been worrying about.
Only one? I don't think you've been paying attention, Lewis. There are dozens of things worrying me.
This one is particularly close to home. There used to be three Paragons guarding and patrolling Logris. You, me, and Finn Durandal. Now there's just the one, Finn. One man to handle all the evils this world can throw at him. And God alone knows what state of mind he's in now he isn't champion after all.
God help whoever he takes it out on. Bad time to be a criminal on Logris, I would have thought.
Has anybody spoken to Finn yet? I tried, but he won't take my calls.
I looked for him after the ceremony, but he disappeared. I tried to reach him later on my private channel as well as my new official one, but he's screening all his calls. All I got was a terse recorded message and a plug for a new website. The man's just sulking, that's all. Doesn't want to talk to anyone because he doesn't trust his temper yet. He always did think too much of himself. He'll get over it, eventually. He's still officially the greatest paragon of all time, and with you out of the way, he'll have less competition for the title. I wouldn't worry about him, Lewis. Finn has a way of bouncing back. And don't worry about Logris either. With all the paragons who turned up to witness my coronation, the planet's never been better guarded. And I've already arranged for a permanent replacement once they're gone. A second paragon for Logris, to take up the slack in our absence.
Anyone I'd know?
Oh, I'd say so. Emma Steele from Mistworld.
Damn. Oh, yes. Oh, she'll do very well here.
Lewis couldn't keep from grinning.
The media's gonna love her. Hard, but fair. But mostly hard.
Oh, growing up on Mistworld will do that for you. She's a real scrapper, just what's needed. She was wasted on Rhiannon anyway. Logris will be much more of a challenge for her. And it'll do Finn good to have someone with as big an ego as his to deal with.
Is Logris big enough to hold two egos that size?
Steele and the Durandal will make excellent partners. If they don't kill each other first.
It's still only two Paragons, not three. And you can bet the Elves will be planning something really nasty in retaliation.
Don't worry about it, dear.
Jessamine moved over to join them. She perched herself daintily on the arm of Douglas's chair and smiled sweetly at Lewis.
Logris survived perfectly well before you came here as Paragon, and it will do just as well now you've moved on. You men always think you're indispensable.
We are now the Empire's king and champion. That makes us indispensable by definition.
Not necessarily.
Anne turned her back on the monitor screens, folded her arms across her chest, and looked severely at Douglas.
You screw up out there in the house today, and all your good intentions will come to nothing. I keep my ear to the ground. I hear things. For some time now, a lot of people have been talking about doing away with the constitutional monarch entirely, making the Empire into a republic or a federation.
People have been saying that since Robert and Constance were crowned.
Yes, but these are important people we're talking about now. People of position and influence. Robert and Constance were adored by the general populace and made important and effective political contributions to the running of things. William and Niamh didn't have that kind of charisma or impact. They were popular enough, but William never had his father's deft political touch or any real interest in acquiring one. God knows I did my best to provide him with information he could use, but he just didn't care. Some unkind people have been saying inside and outside the house that the Empire's already effectively been without a real constitutional monarch for over a century, and managed quite well without one.
People may be saying these things, but is anyone listening? Anyone who matters.
As yet, most people are still reluctant to commit themselves one way or the other. The MPs like having a king and speaker because it detracts attention away from them when they need someone to publicly carry the can for necessary but unpopular measures. But that could change really quickly if you don't convince Parliament that you're too popular, too useful, and too powerful to be easily ousted.
Well, that shouldn't be too difficult. Your record as a paragon shows you're trustworthy. All you have to do today is show everyone that your heart's in the right place.
It's not that simple.
Why not? Let the MPs be devious and shifty and make their little deals in smoke-filled back rooms. The king is supposed to be better than that. Why can't Douglas just stand up for what he believes in?
I really don't have time for this.
Your trouble, Lewis, is that because you're an honourable man, you expect everybody else to be. But the universe doesn't work like that. How someone with your trusting nature ever survived the mean streets of Logras is a mystery to me.
I knew where I was in the mean streets. They were full of criminals and scumbags.
So is Parliament. Nice guys don't survive long in politics, and no one ever got to be a member of Parliament without learning how to fight dirty. They might come into the House meaning well, but they soon learn that idealism doesn't get you anywhere, and good intentions alone won't get you re-elected. You have to be seen to deliver something tangible for the voters back home. Politics is all about the art of the deal and what you can get away with.
Lewis looked at Douglas.
I thought you were planning to change all that.
I am.
Douglas met Lewis's gaze steadily.
In time. But I'm just one man fighting an established system, and a system that, for all its faults, works tolerably well. This is a golden age, after all. Trust me, Lewis, I know what I'm doing.
Well, I wish I did. I don't even know exactly what you want me to do as champion, Douglas. I can't just be a glorified bodyguard standing around waiting for something to happen. You're already surrounded by the best security in the world. I'm not made for ceremonies and looking good in public, nice new outfit or not. I need to be doing something, to be making a difference. Or I swear I'll resign, and you can let Finn have the job anyway.
I need you, Lewis. I'll always need you. To be my sounding board, to be my conscience and keep me honest, as well as keeping me safe.
Right. The best security systems in the world can't keep out a terrorist who doesn't care about dying as long as he can take his target with him. Just by being king, Douglas already has enemies. We've already intercepted over 200 death threats.
Douglas looked at Anne.
We have? And just when were you going to tell me this?
Don't worry about it now. You have an entire department set up to deal with things like that. They nearly always turn out to be cranks anyway.
She's quite right, darling. You should see some of the mail I get. There's a lot of weird people out there with a fixation on public figures and far too much time on their hands. And don't even get me started on stalkers. One man even had a complete body change to look just like me, turned up early at a rehearsal and tried to take over my role. It all fell apart when he started to sing, of course. Personally, I didn't think he looked a bit like me. Had no style at all.
Be that as it may, Parliament security has a lot of experience in dealing with threats. We haven't even had a decent bomb scare in 50 years.
You see? What am I needed for?
Because even the best security people can have a bad day. They have to be lucky all the time. A terrorist only has to get lucky once.
Why would anyone want to kill me? I've made it clear I want to be a good king for all my people, justice for all. Just like when I was a paragon. Who could object to that?
I can have the computers print out a list if you're really interested. Mostly the same people whose asses you used to kick as paragon. Plus, all the people on all sides of the political spectrum with vested interests in maintaining the status quo. Then there's the elves, the Hellfire Club, the Shadow Court.
All right. I get the point.
Good. Now forget about all that and concentrate on the more immediate problem of winning over and or intimidating the MPs. And bear in mind, there's going to be an absolutely huge media presence in the House today. Most of them gagging for a chance to make you look bad in revenge for your father's denying them access to your coronation. King does reasonably well on first day. Isn't going to make headlines. King screws up royally? That's news. So don't give them ammunition to use against you.
Wonderful. More complications. I'll be glad when we've got all this media stuff out of the way and I can get down to some real work.
Jessamine and Anne looked at each other again, and as always, Anne bit the bullet.
Douglas, This media stuff is the real work. You can reach more people, persuade more people through the media than you can any other way. The MPs will respond more to public interest and public pressure than they will to any amount of reasoned debate. Get the people by their heart, or by their balls, and their minds will follow. Get the people behind you, and you'll have the power to do what needs doing.
It always comes down to the audience, darling, bless their black little hearts. Wave and smile, and never let them catch you sweating.
High above the Parade of the Endless, soaring the mild winter skies on his gravity sled, the Paragon Finn Durandal looked down on the people he was supposed to serve and protect and didn't give a damn. He felt nothing for them. But then, he never had. He'd never actually admitted that to himself before, but now that he had, it didn't come as any surprise to him. He didn't fight the bad guys on their behalf, he did it for himself, for the thrill of testing himself against the best opponents. He'd taken pride in his achievements as Paragon, in the legend he'd made of himself. And then, Douglas took it all away, by denying him his rightful place as champion. So, Douglas must be made to pay. Everyone must pay, for allowing this unforgivable insult to happen. Ostensibly, Finn was out on patrol. He told dispatching that he'd be going offline for a while, that he'd be out of touch while he talked to some of his sources, following up a lead on what the Elves were planning next. All nonsense, of course. His patrolling days were over. There was no point in being a Paragon anymore. He was something else now. Though he hadn't actually decided what, yet. A traitor, perhaps. He liked the sound of that. To go against everything he'd been taught, everything he was supposed to believe in, tear it all down and laugh in their shocked faces, all in the name of pride and revenge. Yes. That felt right. From the Empire's greatest hero to its greatest villain. Just because he chose to. He'd never felt happier. Still, if he was going to tear down the whole Empire, he was going to need a certain kind of help. He couldn't be everywhere at once, and he'd always known that to solve the really big problems, you needed experts and specialists. So, after much thought, and not a little research, he'd put together a shopping list of the right, or rather wrong, people. It hadn't been too difficult, not with his Paragon's resources and connections. He'd begin with a certain devious con man. Finn had given Brett Random strict instructions to be at a certain place at a certain time before releasing him, but he never expected Brett to actually show up. In fact, Finn would have been disappointed if he had. It would have meant Brett wasn't the kind of man Finn needed. He knew where Brett would be hiding. All he had to do was go and get him, and the awful thing Finn was planning could begin. He would plunge the Empire into blood and terror, set its cities ablaze, and utterly destroy what men of goodwill had spent two centuries putting together. Just to please his wounded pride. Finn Durandal descended on his gravity sled into the hidden dark heart of the Parade of the Endless, smiling a predator's smile. His heart beating just a little faster in anticipation. It was called the Rookery, a square mile or so of territory right in the center of the city that didn't officially exist. A dark and dangerous warren of crammed together buildings and alleyways that hadn't changed its unpleasant nature in hundreds of years. All records of its existence had been erased long ago, in the time of rebuilding after the Great Rebellion. All it took was a little money in the right hands, and all the official maps and computers conveniently forgot that there had ever been an old thieves' quarter. Public transport was routed around it, and knowledge of the few remaining ways in and out was passed down verbally, and only to those who needed to know. It had its own power supply, its own secret economy, and you entered entirely at your own risk. The Rookery existed because people will always need somewhere to buy and sell the kinds of pleasures you're not supposed to want in a golden age. The Three Cripples was a bar of the very worst character. Seedy would have been a step up. It was a dark, sprawling place with blacked-out windows, good booze, indifferent food, and a rotten reputation.
You got in by intimidating or bribing the doorman, and after that you were fair game for every thief, cheat, thug, and doxy who called the bar home. Most notably, it was a regular haunt for the ever-changing crowd of undesirables who called themselves Random's Bastards.
Another one for my good friend What's-His-Face here. And what are you ladies having? Drinks all around on me.
In the main bar, in an atmosphere thick with smoke that was almost wholly illegal in nature, Brett Random was buying drinks for one and all, on the strength of the more than serious money he'd made selling his unauthorized coverage of King Douglas's coronation. The tabloid news channels had all but gone to war over the bidding, and Brett had played them off against each other with a slickness that impressed even him. Brett Random was rich. But money had never really mattered much to him. The game was what mattered. Money was just how you kept score. So, it was drinks on the house, and the best of everything for him and his friends, while it lasted. And then he'd go out and dip into some other sucker's pockets, metaphorically speaking. It was what he did best. As long as the money kept flowing, there was no shortage of people willing to drink and carouse at his expense, and tell him what a fine fellow he was, so Brett had a large, noisy, and good-natured audience all to himself.
Come one and all, and pay your respects to the greatest of all of Random's Bastards.
His audience was a motley crowd, all considered, men and women from 100 worlds and societies, most of whom couldn't go home again. Sometimes their families actually sent them regular payments on the understanding that they'd stay away. They lived the outlaw life and thrived on it, preying on the suckers and each other with equal glee. The death rate was high, but they found ways to keep cheerful, most of them illegal outside of the rookery. There were even some aliens, certain individuals who developed tastes or needs that couldn't be satisfied back on their homeworlds, or who'd gone native after spending too long among humankind and couldn't be allowed back for fear of contamination. The rookery embraced them all. It was a vile and squalid place, where they'd steal the fillings out of your teeth while you slept, but it could still be a kind of home for those who needed it, for those with nowhere else to go. In the rookery, lost souls found kindred spirits and stayed to work quiet and very profitable revenges against those who had driven them there. Several saucy-looking waitresses with exactly the same face moved among the tables, laughing and joking.
Watch it now!
And slapping the occasional face as they dispensed drinks, drugs, and bar snacks of a rather unsavory nature, all of it on Brett's tab. The waitresses were clones. Madeline's, to be exact, a waitress franchise currently very popular in cities everywhere. These were knockoffs, of course, bootleg copies. And in the rookery, these Madeline's owned their own contracts. Brett Random sat on the exact middle of the long wooden bar counter, legs dangling, face flushed, ripped to the tits on absinthe, crazy as a bag full of weasels, and happy as the night is long. The only thing better than running a successful con was boasting of it afterwards, preferably to a crowd of his compatriots who were secretly eating their hearts out with jealousy. He got rid of the distracting bright red hair, had a new eye put in to replace his spy camera, and was now back to his usual mousy brown hair, mild brown eyes, and a weakly handsome face. His real appearance, that he only ever showed to his own kind. He had told the indulgent crowd again how he'd sneaked into the court, and all the things he'd seen and done while he was there, including many things he'd thought about doing, or wished he could have. He made a big thing of how he'd escaped afterwards, with court security baying at his heels, but drunk as he was, he still had enough sense not to mention Finn's involvement. They wouldn't have understood. Hell, he was there, and he didn't understand it. Besides, he didn't like to think about Finn Durandal. The man scared him. Ditching the Paragon was the smartest thing he'd ever done. Brett Random hadn't got where he was without being able to recognize trouble when he saw it. Brett stopped boasting to prepare himself another drink. It took a while, but it was worth it. Brett always drank absinthe when he had the money. There were other drinks that tasted better or got you legless faster, but for sheer half-brick-to-the-side-of-the-head impact, there was absolutely nothing to match absinthe. It cost an arm and a leg, was bad for you in practically every way possible, and some of the hallucinations it brought could be downright unsettling, but drink enough of it, and the world could be a fine and wondrous place. But most of all, Brett loved the ritual of it. First, pour yourself a glass of absinthe and place it on the bar. Next, take a spoon, flat, pure silver, shaped like a leaf, and place it over the top of the glass. Next, place a sugar lump on the spoon. Then dilute your drink by dripping spring water over the sugar lump until the liquor below turns from a dull blue into a vivid green. Then, and only then, drink. And hold on to your hat. Absinthe could do major damage to the liver, the kidneys, and the brain, but it was very good for the soul, especially when taken to excess. Suitably refreshed, Brett turned back to an audience even more refreshed than he was. In fact, some of them were so refreshed, they weren't even in the same time zone as he.
My fellow bastards! So good to be back among family again. Fleecing the sheep can be fun as well as profitable, but it's only here with you that I really feel at home. In a very real way, I like to think of you as all my children, gathering at my knee to listen and learn. I have this strange urge to make you all go upstairs and tidy your rooms. Are you all wearing clean underwear? Then feel free to go out and get knocked down by a truck. I promise I won't give a fuck. But never forget, boys and girls, you may be Roundham's bastards, but I alone am worthy of the title The Bastard. My father, as many times removed as he could stand, was the legendary Jack Roundham. Just like all of you. God, he put it around. But my dear mother, equally removed, was the just as legendary Ruby Journey. My genes are so damned heroic, it's a wonder I'm able to bear being in the same room as the rest of you lot.
He grinned unmoved into the face of raucous derision from the crowd, who might be pissed as farts, but could still recognize bullshit when they heard it. Even the Madeline stopped serving long enough to jeer at him and throw things. One of them threw her room keys. Brett plucked them out of midair with practiced ease and dropped her a wink. A half-alien in the front row stood up.
Ruby Journey famously never had any children. Everyone knows that.
Jack and Ruby donated sperm and eggs before their last mission. It was a charity thing.
Oh, Ruby wasn't known for being charitable either, not unless it involved killing people.
Oh, shut it. You're just jealous.
And that was when the Paragon Finn Durandal strode casually into the bar. The crowd immediately began running in all directions.
Special egg and sperm don't mean you can see... Oh, hello.
Brett was so drunk, he actually hesitated before jumping down from the bar with the express intent of legging it for the nearest horizon, or possibly the one beyond. But that hesitation was all the time Finn needed to draw a bead on Brett Roundham and shoot him in the stomach.
Whoa.
Brett looked down at the dart sticking out of his gut, recognized the distinctive green and white markings on the feathers, and just had time to mouth the words,
"Oh, shit!"
before the compressed air in the barrel of the dart shot the dose of purge straight into his system. His whole body convulsed, slamming him back against the wooden bar. And then he was on the floor, flailing like a madman.
Kill me!
Purge was an industrial strength sobering agent, absolutely guaranteed to remove all toxins and intoxicants from a person's body in a matter of seconds, by the shortest route possible. Or, to put it another way, via every orifice possible. Didn't matter whether you were drunk, stoned, or in a parallel reality to this one, Purge would have you stone-cold sober in under a minute, and make you regret every one of those 50-odd seconds. Saying Purge had a dramatic effect was like saying the Empress Lionstone could get a bit touchy on occasions. Finn watched the projectile vomiting from a safe distance, entirely unmoved. And when the nastiness was finally over, and Brett had been reduced to a sweating, quivering, trembling mess with his back propped up against the bar, Finn strolled casually over to join him, politely ignoring the smell, and drank the last of the absinthe.
Charming place you have here. Really quite charming. Such ambience. And so many guilty consciences in one place. You'd think they'd had something to hide. How are you feeling, Brett?
Sober. I don't think I've been this sober since I was born. God, it feels awful. You bastard, Finn. I'll never be able to come in here again. And I was just about to get lucky, too. How the hell did you track me here?
I know lots of things I'm not supposed to. I just file it all away until the time comes when I can make use of it. Get up.
Oh, sure, just like that. Give me a hand.
Not if you were drowning. Get up.
Brett slowly levered himself to his feet and really hoped it was just sweat trickling down his legs. He tried to glare at Finn, but didn't have the energy.
What do you want with me, Paragon? I'm just a con man. No one's special. You can find 100 like me in the rookery. Well, 12.
I want you. You and no other. Though perhaps not quite so close just at the moment. We really are going to have to find you a shower and a change of clothes before we leave. That's the trouble with dramatic gestures. There's always so much mess to clean up afterwards. Ask the elves at the arena, if you know a good spiritualist. Now, Brett, you are going to work for me for as long as I require it. Or I can kill you, right here and now. Never let it be said that I didn't give you a free choice in the matter. Oh, don't look so glum, Brett. Stick with me, and I promise you protection from the law, more wealth than even you ever dreamed of, and the satisfaction of seeing all kinds of authority figures humbled and brought low. What more could you possibly wish for?
A 10-minute head start?
Brett had enough sense not to say that out loud.
I know you. Hell, everyone on Logos knows about you. Why would the great and legendary hero Finn Durandal suddenly decide to go bad?
Finn shrugged easily.
Perhaps because it's the only thing I haven't tried yet.
But why me?
A coincidence at first. You gave yourself away at court, you know. You were far too good at your job. Most real waiters have a certain sullen evasiveness, never there when you want them. And once I looked carefully, I spotted the camera eyes straight away. I was going to let court security deal with you after the ceremony, rather than spoil the atmosphere. But afterwards... Well, once I had my computers run a check on your background, I realized you were perfect for my needs. You know people, Brett. You have contacts in all sorts of dark and unsavory places. People who wouldn't talk to me will talk to you. We were meant to meet, you and I. You are part of my destiny.
He's crazy. All that goodness and heroics finally sent him over the edge, and he flipped.
But just because he's loopy doesn't mean he can't deliver all the things he says he can.
All right, I'm your man. Are you really serious about bringing down a whole empire?
Deadly serious.
Finn smiled again. Brett really wished he wouldn't. It was a distinctly disturbing smile.
And when the empire is in ruins, the king disgraced and deposed, and the people are on their knees begging for a savior, they'll come to me to save them. And I will. I'll raise them up and make the empire great and glorious again, in my own image and according to my own needs, naturally. And then everyone will finally know that I am the better man.
Oh, yeah. You get my vote for Loony of the Year.
Question. How are you, even with my very experienced help, going to bring down hundreds of civilized worlds?
By setting them at each other's throats. Once you're all shining clean again, and somewhat easier on the nostrils, you don't leave my side. We're partners. Guess which one of us is the junior, and don't sulk like that, or I'll hurt you.
All right, senior partner. Where are we going first?
Shopping. You will accompany me as I gather together the rest of the people who are going to assist me in my glorious cause, even if they don't know it yet.
What sort of people are we talking about here? The Shadow Court? The Hellfire Club?
Oh, no. Or at least, not yet. They're buried so deep, even I'd have trouble finding the right stone to look under. And they are, after all, the kind of people it's best to deal with from a position of strength.
When the time is right, when they've seen what I can do, they'll come to me. No, Brett. To start with, I thought we'd pay a pleasant little social call on the wild rose of the arenas.
Oh, shit.